The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And here's something you might find alarming. Innocent until proven guilty. Now, I suspect you're quite familiar with this principle from the U.S. criminal justice system. It's a great idea for preventing the imprisonment of innocent people, but it's not such a great idea for preventing the contamination of your drinking water. That's right. As far as your water is concerned, a new chemical introduced into your aquifer, say a factory moves in, a storage facility, farmers switch to a new brand of fertilizer or pesticide that hasn't been tested, a mine or rock quarry goes into operation, the chemicals in that runoff are presumed not to be a problem in your water, by and large, unless there is evidence that it is toxic or causes health problems. And now that evidence, you would hope, comes from a lab and doctors and chemists, right? But under the current system, the first evidence of the presence of chemicals and their hazards might also be your own kids or yourself noticing a change in the quality of drinking water, getting sick, or worse, learning your family has been permanently contaminated in some way. The public health emergency in Flint, Michigan, you'll recall a switch to a new water source and government neglect left a population to complain of water that was unfit to drink and eventually was found with extremely high levels of lead and other chemicals for 18 months until something was done. That crisis has raised the question for everyone. How much do we really know about our water?
Hi, this is Salita from Girdwood, Alaska. My water flows into my tiny off-the-grid cabin through a hose in the creek that is filled from a pristine mountain stream that bubbles out about 100 feet from my door. I find it difficult to drink any other water, especially city water. In our small community, there is currently a vigorous debate occurring because the larger municipality has decided to reintroduce fluoride into the city water supply against the strong and vocal opposition of the entire community.
My name is Erin from Richmond, Virginia. Dominion Power just signed a bill to dump coal ash into the James River. I'm sickened and terrified for what could lie ahead if we do not act soon.
Pembroke Pines, Florida, the water is constantly yellow. Despite the overwhelming chlorine taste and smell, boiling it and various water filters don't work. Not long ago, we received a letter in the mail from the city saying our local water facility was aware 8 weeks prior that the fecal coliform and E. coli levels were not to health standards, but they chose not to notify residents. A 2009 New York Times investigation found that over 62 million Americans had been exposed to drinking water that did not meet some government health guideline. Another analysis in 2011 by the Environmental Working Group found that over 100 million people in 43 states were drinking water contaminated by trihalomethanes, a dangerous chemical that's the byproduct of chlorine. Is your water innocent until proven contaminated, or should it be the other way around? Before they can say something is safe to drink, municipalities have to prove or certify that the water is safe. Joining me now is Jeffrey Griffiths, a professor of public health at Tufts University and a former chair of the EPA's Drinking Water Committee Science Advisory Board. Professor, welcome.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Do you think that principle is basically what's going on with the drinking water supply, that chemicals are kind of innocent until proven guilty?
Unfortunately so. I think yes.
Now, one of the things that mystifies me here is that according to the EPA, Flint was required to use a chemical that would have prevented the lead and other chemicals and other metals from leaching from the old pipes in Flint, correct?
That's correct.
Now, what is that chemical and how is that not a contaminant in and of itself?
Well, some chemicals are very small ones that are, in fact, ones that we even have in our bodies. And this is a phosphate corrosion inhibitor. And so phosphates are components of our own cells and of the natural universe in really high amounts. Phosphates could contribute to the growth of algae and things like that when used like as fertilizer. The amounts that we use in water to inhibit corrosion, they are you know, safe, and these are small compounds that are not the kind of things that cause cancer or things like that.
But it is the case that, you know, it goes way beyond chlorine, the kinds of things that are in your water, and you may or may not know anything about them. And you say that that's fine, but in this innocent until proven guilty situation, you know, there are chemicals that can get in there that do cause problems. What do you most worry about?
Oh, I worry about the fact that we live kind of in a sea of small level chemical contaminants. The number of chemicals that are actually regulated within the United States are relatively small compared to the total number of chemicals that have been detected in water. And we don't really know what happens when you're exposed to very low levels of many hundreds of chemicals. If you live in a place where you're taking your drinking water from a river, which has seen a lot of industrial use upstream or a lot of farming activity, then you may have chemicals in the water that are present not at high levels, and in fact, trace levels of things where we don't even understand what the effects are. And the standards for drinking water treatment in the United States are not to remove all chemicals, but rather reduce the amount. Often there is not the assumption that you can actually remove it all. So that I really worry about the kind of the large spectrum of things that we're exposed to at low levels where we don't understand what the effects are.
So conceivably someone worried about the Flint situation could take their water to a chemist and discover a whole range of surprises that relate to things that are happening around them that add to this chemical soup that you're talking about. And the chemist could say, yeah, you got a lot of this and this and this and this. And the person would say, is that a problem? The chemist would go, we don't know. Can you get rid of it? And the chemist would say, we don't know. And that's the situation we're in?
Well, it's a little bit better than that, but not much better than that. There are methods for removing chemicals in a broad way. And you could imagine things like running water through activated charcoal or through filters that are extremely stringent, very tight filters, where all that really gets through is the water molecules and not chemical compounds. And so those forms of treatment are not common in the United States because of the expense. If we were interested in removing all chemicals out of water and all heavy metals and all that kind of thing, then we would really have to change the standard treatment that most municipalities undergo.
Finally, before we go, if there's a standard that says there could be this amount of sort of rat poison or bacteria in the water, and that's the standard, but then suddenly we realize that actually it needs to be lower than that. What's the circumstance that determines that? Somebody has to get sick from it? I mean, we basically wait until somebody keels over?
Well, there's two ways that that happens. One is just as you've described it, somebody keels over and then there's quote unquote new information. And the other might be that in fact, there's information from a laboratory where somebody is doing this and they go, oh, holy Toledo, you know, this is 100 times too much. Or there's a new side effect that's found in some experiments and so forth. But I've got to say that for most compounds that are out there, we don't have the toxicology. So unfortunately, there have been a number of instances where people have gotten sick, and that's really changed the equation in terms of what we know is good or bad. Just to give you an example, lead used to be thought to be bad, and the acceptable amount was much higher than what the acceptable amount is now because there was new information about damage to babies and brain development and things like that. And people said, oh, we've got to ratchet it down. And so that's happened. But, you know, the truth is there is no such thing as a safe amount of lead in water. There's no such thing as a safe amount of arsenic in water. But the removal of those is costly. And therefore, we have standards which allow trace amounts of those. There's obviously a very vigorous public health debate about whether or not those should be allowed at all.
If there are individuals listening to this program, and, you know, conspiracy theories often revolve around the water supply, lots of famous stories and movies about that. So one can be very paranoid about one's water for good reason, and they want to get those filters that you're talking about that are not necessarily commercially available but are really, really effective. Where would they go to investigate that?
Oh, there's lots of companies that make filters which will remove, as I said, heavy metals and will remove the vast, vast majority of chemicals that are organic chemicals found in water. They are relatively expensive. And I think there are equity issues that arise because these are available to people with the wherewithal to do that. but most people don't have a couple of $1,000 or $3,000 or something like that to install such a system within their house. And one would hope that municipalities provide clean, safe water to everyone as part of the basic contract that we have with our cities and municipalities. There's another piece to this equation, which is also that when people have suggested such things, a lot of people within a community have said they don't want it because it costs too much. And they would ask then, what's the evidence that we need to get rid of those extra chemicals? And that's kind of a major problem. We don't have evidence in the same rigorous way that we have for a small number of chemicals for the larger group. Then it becomes hard to justify the extra expense, especially when we've just been through the Great Recession and things like that.
Innocent until proven guilty. That's the principle for the water. And we've already seen that disparity in what rich people are able to do and what the poor are stuck with in water in the Flint case.
It's terrible.
Jeffrey Griffiths is a professor of public health at Tufts University and former chair of the EPA's Drinking Water Committee Science Advisory Board. Thanks so much, Professor.
My pleasure.
It was a British television producer, Mark Burnett, who made Donald Trump a TV star, you may remember, on The Apprentice.
He said, hello, Donald, hi, it's Mark Burnett, you know, Survivor. He went, hey, how you doing, genius? You know, he said, what do you want? You know, very Trump, right? And I said, well, you know, I've got an idea for my next reality show, you know, to follow Survivor. And it's something that I think you want to be a part of. He said, okay.
Burnett, with little help from Trump himself, created a monster. From 2004, Trump hosted 14 seasons of The Apprentice. At one point, it was one of the highest-rated shows. As a presidential candidate, though, Trump's comments about Muslims led a million people in Britain to sign a petition to ban him from the UK and the golf course and resort he owns in Scotland.
Donald Trump is a fool. He is free to be a fool. He is not free to be a dangerous fool on our shores.
Aw, so now you want to ban him. Well, not everyone.
This motion is actually embarrassing to the UK and makes us look intolerant and totalitarian. And I feel we should almost apologise to the people of the United States.
I draw the line at freedom of speech when it actually imports violent ideology, which is what I feel is happening. The legislation in place is to protect the public and protect the people of Britain.
No reason to apologize. The debate was non-binding. No vote was taken. No hard feelings. Just some clever venting.
His comments regarding Muslims are wrong. His policy to close borders, if he is elected as president, is bonkers. And if he met one or two of my constituents in one of the many excellent pubs in my constituency, then they may well tell him that he is a wazzock for dealing with this issue in this way. God save the Queen,
the fascist regime. Join us tomorrow on The Takeaway when author Bill Bryson will help us to understand other curious quirks and contradictions in the distinctive, sometimes bizarre, British psyche.
But it has to be said, I mean, genuinely, it has to be said that Britain is probably the best place in the world, a psychiatric hospital is probably the best place in Britain to get to know the country.
Bill Bryson, tomorrow on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We started this hour talking about how misguided trust can set communities up for some serious health problems regarding their drinking water supply. We now have a story about potentially misguided mistrust. In Perry County, Alabama, a long history of racism and memories of the Tuskegee experiments, where doctors left syphilis untreated to study the effects of the disease, would be more than rational reason to mistrust the medical system. But a tuberculosis outbreak in Marion, Alabama, may have been fueled by a fear of doctors. As many as 20 people have been diagnosed in Perry County, and three have died in the majority black community, where a third live below the poverty line. Health officials are finding that they have to offer cash for people to get tested and treated. Pam Barrett is director of the Division for TB Control for the Alabama Department of Public Health. She is leading the state response in Marion. She joins me now. Pam, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
Can you describe this unusual relationship between citizens and their public health professionals, this potential and apparent lack of trust?
Well, the community itself seems to be not really receptive to naming names, and you know, when we find active cases, they are very hesitant to tell us who they have been around. So it has severely hindered any follow-up in seeking contacts to identify and treat preventively. And that caused a snowball effect beginning in 2014, which has led us to where we are today.
Where did this originate, do you think?
Well, we think there was one or two cases in late 2013, early 2014 that began this. They were the original cases that were identified, and subsequent cases did admit to knowing those individuals. But when asked why they did not seek to come to be tested, they really didn't have an answer. They just said they just didn't.
How much of this has produced an accusation of intolerance on the part of the government, or a sense of dismissiveness in that because this is a poor community, because it's mostly black, there wasn't the urgency here as there might have been in other communities?
Well, the urgency has always been here. We have, you know, since the first cases were identified, we have been on the ground. We've been working with community leaders and trying to get people in for screening, and we've used, you know, other methods with non-monetary incentives, but these did not yield good results. So we had to develop a plan, which now seems to be working. So we're grateful for the response of the citizens of Perry County. I think a lot of people are truly concerned for their health, and have came out to be tested. But also we are seeing a lot of people who are saying that the only reason that they're being screened is for the money.
How much money are people getting if they come in?
They get $20 if they come in to be screened. They get another $20 if they come in to get their test results. If they need a chest x-ray, they will get $20 for keeping their x-ray appointment. And then if it's recommended that they take preventive medicine, we will give them $100 if they complete their medicine. That would be at the end of their treatment.
Now, Alabama made the political decision not to be a part of the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. Do you think that poor people in Alabama would be more conscious of their health needs and their health options if they had had Medicaid coverage?
I really can't answer that because I work for the state and we have close ties with Medicaid, and that's a very touchy subject here in the state, and I'm just not able to really go down that path.
Pam Barrett is director for the Division of TB Control for the Alabama Department of Public Health. She is the state official who is leading the response in Marion. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Turns out that, like once popular mood rings, distant stars thought to be planet-free are actually sporting rings of exoplanets. Astronomers have charted thousands of exoplanets and estimate that there could be 20 billion or more habitable planets just in our own galaxy. And with 200 million galaxies in the universe, we are way behind in naming these planets something other than, say, 42 Draconis B or PSR 1257 plus 12C. Scientists like those sort of names. But now the International Astronomical Union has released new names for 32 exoplanets and 14 stars they revolve around. Names like Orbitar, Musica, and Poltergeist. The names were proposed by various astronomy groups and voters from 182 countries. For more on this, we turn to Sarah Seeger, exoplanet astronomer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. This is kind of populist science here, right, Sarah?
Yes, it definitely is. But it's great that people can contribute to naming exoplanets.
And there's nothing scientific about naming, but there is something very important about getting citizens involved in the new missions to explore the exoplanets that you're working on right now.
Well, definitely. And we have this phrase, the sky is for everyone, and so are the planets.
Who judged these names?
Well, they were voted on, actually, by the general public. So the process that the naming body, International Astronomical Union, used was quite democratic, actually. First, they had people choose which stars and planets to actually name. Then they solicited proposals from organizations, and then they let the public vote on the proposed names.
And what were the rules? I mean, I'm assuming I wouldn't have been able to name a planet My Mom Nancy.
Right, exactly. There were a list of rules, about six or seven bulleted points, so no names of living people. So unfortunately, we couldn't propose John Hockenberry, for example.
I think that's totally fine, actually.
Nothing, yeah. Nothing offensive and things like that, not after your pet or anything. So they were sort of a generic list of names. But I think they were also hoping, and this worked out, that the clubs, the organizations, would screen anything that was rude or inappropriate. And so hopefully only really good names were proposed.
You know, you said there could be no John Hockenberry planet, but apparently there is a Sarah Seeger asteroid.
Right. This is my own personal opinion that someday we may name exoplanets after people when we have enough of them, so we feel like we're not really limited in any way.
What are the missions that are out there? You've described them once for us, but again, they're so fascinating in the methodology that they're going to use to further explore the exoplanets. Give us a thumbnail.
Well, there's so many missions, and actually it relates to the planet names. Probably the most famous mission out there is the Kepler Space Telescope, which completed its primary mission and found thousands and thousands of planets. So if you come across a planet with the name Kepler, Kepler-186b, for example, you know that that was one of the planets discovered by Kepler. There are other missions, many other telescopes we use to study planets. Kepler was the first dedicated mission for exoplanets. One of my main jobs right now is working on an MIT-led NASA mission called TESS, Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, and we're going to launch in 2017 on a SpaceX Falcon 9. So we actually watch the SpaceX launches very closely.
How will the transiting satellite work? And then describe before we go the shadowing system that's also proposed and on the drawing board.
Well, the transiting technique right now, it's the only way we have to find very small planets. And the TESS mission will actually be an all-sky survey. It'll spend 1 year looking at fields of the sky, 90-degree strips of sky at a time, each for about a month, all across the one hemisphere. And then the next year, it'll look across the next hemisphere. And I'll tell you what, we really think that the whole entire world of professional astronomers is on board to help follow up the signals we find to find out whether or not they're planets. Now, actually, I'm really happy you asked about my absolute favorite project. We call it Starshade. And that would come much later. We're in the process of developing the technology and getting the project to a level where we can actually plan to build it. And Starshade will be a giant screen in space, about 30 meters, about 100 feet in diameter. That's huge. And the Starshade is a specially shaped screen that would fly tens of thousands of kilometers from a telescope, also in space. The two things would be in space, and the Starshade would block out the starlight so only the planet light enters the telescope. The reason we're so enthused about the Starshade is it'll be our first chance to find a true Earth twin, a planet like Earth orbiting a star like the Sun.
Sarah Seeger is an exoplanet astronomer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Get back to work now.
I will. I'll be working on the Starshade.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Hey, you know, you can listen back to our series on exoplanets we did last spring. You can just head over to thetakeaway.org. What about our own planet? It's got more than a billion years of history we are only just now starting to understand. Paleogeologists are serious historians. They do not study the rocks under our feet. They imagine what rocks might have been under anyone's feet hundreds of millions of years ago. And it turns out that brand new ways of digitizing Earth's magnetic data, along with new ways of visualizing big data sets, have transformed the way we understand the very beginnings of our world. And we can suddenly watch how ancient supercontinents like Pangaea became the map we see today. Steve Levine is the Washington correspondent for Quartz, and he wrote about this research for QZ.com.
There is a magnetic signature that's locked into the lava that's at the bottom of the sea. And the original paleogeologists, they were dragging tools across the sea during World War II to help us find German submarines. The Navy thought this was so cool, so after the war ended, it funded them for 2.5 decades.
It's amazing. And then you've got in this article these amazing animations that show the continents coming together, becoming – there's Pangaea. And then you keep going up to about, 600 million years. It becomes – what's the name of the next one?
Rodinia.
Rodinia. And then when you end up 750 million years ago, the continents are spread out in a completely different configuration.
That's right. The whole idea that the Earth has gone through these different configurations, if you go back 1 billion years, you have one set of continents. And if you go back another billion years, another set, and so on.
Well, talking about today, how do you think this plate tectonics and continental drift and idea of supercontinents affects what's going on in the world today? Just off the top of my head, it seems to me that the earthquake zones of Japan and Pakistan and Nepal and those areas and the west coast of California are one of the legacies.
Well, that's right. What the plate tectonics tell you, and what's so fascinating, and I think just not spoken about, is how geology has set the stage and continues to set the stage for what we watch. So in the case of earthquakes, back in 2011, two plates rubbed together east of China, caused a 9.0 earthquake. That triggered a tsunami that engulfed Fukushima. We all know about this, which caused France, Germany, China, and Japan to shut down their nuclear reactors, which then led to Germany to juice up its renewable fuel industry, which brought down the price of solar panels. You had this cascading reaction, all of them from geology. Today, we're looking at oil. That's a battle to the death of geologies. It's Saudi Arabia's geology, and it has declared a battle, a war against America's geology. And there's going to be blood on the floor. A third of American oil companies could end up in bankruptcy, and Saudi Arabia is putting itself under real pressure. It's having to impose taxes on its population for the first time, raise fuel prices, both of which risk unpopularity for the Al Saud family. And analysts think there's a very real danger of political instability in Saudi Arabia. The same dynamics are playing out in Russia. And again, all this flows from the battle of geology.
When you look at the continental drift configuration that we have in our time, would you say that we've been left with a set of lucky breaks with the way the geology has turned out? Or has it been kind of a bad sort of noose around our neck, this oil and the addiction to energy and that sort of thing?
This is a big question about is oil a curse? Geology sets the stage. So for some countries, it's given them access to oil, to gas, to various minerals. And after that, it's up to humans to decide what they're going to do with it. And some countries have managed that well. Norway, for example, the United States hasn't done so badly with it. And then you have the Nigerias and the Equatorial Guineas that don't manage it well. I don't think you can call it a bad break. You can just say that all of the economic surge that we've seen over the last two centuries has been a confluence of two forces on Earth. One is geology. One is that there's been a capture of fossil fuels, of geology, coal and oil, but also this technological surge. And those together have given us everything that we've had. But humans need to intervene.
How would we determine in our exploration of space a signature of a planet that has plate tectonics if we were looking for intelligent life?
A couple of postdocs at the University of Washington appear to have come upon one way, and that's volcanoes. Looking at the signature of the atmospheres, they've been able to figure out how to determine if there's volcanism on planets. But what they need to do is they're waiting for the next big telescope that's going to be put into orbit. Right now it's scheduled to go up in 2018. They're hoping to put instruments on that space telescope and for the first time be able to try to detect volcanism on exoplanets way out there in the galaxies.
Plate tectonics, it was once a theory. Now it's a fact on Earth, and it may just be the key to discovering life in the universe.
Exactly.
Amazing. Steve Levine is a Washington correspondent for Quartz, author of the forthcoming book, The Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War. There's another story.
That's another story, yeah.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Indira Gandhi was one of the towering political figures of the 20th century. She was elected India's first female prime minister after succeeding her father, Jawaharlal Nehru, 50 years ago today. Here she is speaking to the press back in 1971.
India has always tried to be on the side of peace and negotiations and so on. But of course we can't endanger our security in any way.
Peace and military strength led Gandhi to swing between brutal authoritarianism and a populist vision for the world's largest democracy. Gandhi served three consecutive terms between 1966 and 1977 and another term in 1980. Here she is defending her restrictions on the press and a state of emergency to Thames Television in 1978.
Only India has tried this experiment of having social and economic changes through peaceful and democratic means. Now, when these means were threatened, we took a temporary measure. It was I declared the emergency, but also I who revoked
it. Immediately before the elections, 21 months later.
Well, certainly, but then I did hold the elections. I don't think there's a single instance in world history of this happening.
The Shah Commission concluded that the reasons
ended. I haven't ended at all. Because since you're talking about the press, I would like to say something about the press here.
Mark Tully, author of From Raj to Rajiv, 40 Years of Indian Independence and former New Delhi bureau chief for the BBC, says it was Indira Gandhi's political brashness that gave her great strength, but ultimately led to her death in 1984. She was assassinated by two of her Sikh bodyguards on October 31st, 1984.
Indira Gandhi was probably the most powerful prime minister India has ever had, but she was also someone who used her power to, I think many people would say, undermine the institutions of India and undermine the democracy within her own party. And also she started this tendency of dynastic rule. She was, of course, the daughter of the first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, but most people wouldn't say that Nehru deliberately intended that his daughter should succeed him. But Indira Gandhi certainly was determined that her son should succeed her.
On the world stage, what kind of a character was she? I've been spending a lot of time reading about the situation right before the war for Bangladesh. And the relationship between Indira Gandhi and Richard Nixon was extraordinarily difficult and tense.
Yes, I think in general, first of all, the internationally people had the impression that she was the Empress of India, a very powerful and very autocratic woman. And basically the other thing, of course, about her when it came to her foreign policy was that she did lean very heavily on the Soviet Union. And in some ways this was justified because during the lead up to the Bangladesh war, America was very hostile to India. And that's why Indira Gandhi felt she had to compensate by signing a treaty of peace and friendship with the Soviet Union.
And the hostility came from Richard Nixon, who treated her with very little respect, Kissinger the same way. And in many ways, the U.S. brought on a humanitarian crisis in the Bangladesh war, even though it has been said that Indira Gandhi took advantage of that war as well. How do you see it looking back now?
Well, I think the people who really created the crisis were the Pakistan and the Pakistan army and the military ruler of Pakistan at that time, who refused to accept the result of an election which he himself had called. There's no doubt about it that Indira Gandhi did train and assist the resistance movement, the Mukti Bahini, as they were called, after the Pakistan army crackdown. But there was no going back after that crackdown.
In her relationship with the various ethnicities in India, how would you say she was able to be a mediator to Muslims, Hindus, and Sikhs, or did she fail at that?
Well, she certainly failed with the Sikhs, who had been very loyal and very positive community in India and a very prosperous one. By mishandling the Sikh crisis, and she did mishandle it, she in fact encouraged the Sikh leader Sanjanel Singh Bhindranwale, because they wanted to have a rival Sikh So by playing politics with Sikhism and with Sikhs, she created this crisis which led to her assassination.
Is it fair to say that her skill in politics also led her to overreach in this case and others?
I think the problem with Indira Gandhi, which a lot of people don't realize, actually, is that she was not that decisive. Because if you look at her record in the very early days of her prime ministership, she was very, very uncertain of herself, very uncertain in her parliamentary performance. And things started to get out of control until she reacted by splitting the Congress party. Then in that period after the Bangladesh war, 4 years after her election and after everyone saying she was the Empress of India, the situation was so out of control that she felt it necessary to call the emergency. And then in the third period of her office, that was, of course, the period of the office where she let the situation in Punjab get out of control and had that disastrous attack on the Golden Temple. So although she appeared to be very tough, when it came to taking major big decisions, she was indecisive, let things slip until she had to come back and do something drastic. And in doing so, she, so to speak, smashed up the shop, if you could put it like that.
If it is the case that she smashed up the shop for the Congress party, to be sure, do you think that is in part responsible for the rise of Modi, who's really seen as a dominant leader in India right now? And I wonder if there are any echoes from the style of Indira Gandhi in the style of Mr. Modi.
Well, yes, certainly Indira Gandhi did undermine the Congress party because she over-centralized power. She was too dominant politically. And at the same time, to make matters worse, she was very nervous and uncertain, and she would never allow any rival leadership to come up. Now, to be a really national leader and a really national party in a country as diverse as India in every sense, you must, in my view, be prepared to allow strong leadership to come up in the different parts of India as well. And Indira Gandhi did not do that. And so for that reason, she weakened the Congress party drastically, and it has never really recovered from that weakening. Modi is in some ways quite similar to Indira Gandhi because he centers all power on himself. He doesn't allow for any form of rivalry to come up. He hasn't really got strong leaders or allowed strong leaders in the different states. And he rules, as one senior BJP man, that's Modi's party, said to me, Modi rules by fear. And this was the way that Indira Gandhi also ruled by fear within her own party.
Mark Tully, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Mark Tully is the author of From Raj to Rajiv, 40 Years of Indian Independence, and he's a former New Delhi bureau chief for the BBC. He spoke to us from Delhi. And finally, we were just trying to see if you were paying attention. I mean, a correction right now and an update. Yesterday, I said Houghton Lake is in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and what I meant to say is Houghton, Michigan is in the Upper Peninsula. Houghton Lake is in central Michigan. We were talking about gas prices, thanks to Kay Margaret, who tweeted us yesterday. There is a price war among gas stations in Houghton Lake, Michigan, driving the price of a gallon of gas down to just 47 cents a gallon. The last time prices were that low was in 1973. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Hockenberry. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints, and do my best to get back to you personally. Tweet me your comments, questions, corrections. I'm at Jay Hockenberry.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.